Move 37, a decision made by an AI system by the name of AlphaGo, of course, that absolutely shook and shattered the world's perception of what AI is capable of. Now, from AlphaGo learning to make choices that humans couldn't even fathom, to modern language models redefining agentic learning, reinforcement learning has become the engine powering massive advancements across multiple modalities. Today, Jonathan and I discuss the future of RL, examining how its power evolves with varying degrees of human input, as well as understanding Turing's role in driving breakthroughs with its partner labs. With that, hi, Jonathan. How are you doing today?
Pretty good, Ashni. How are you doing?
Doing great, thanks. Why don't we just dive straight into reinforcement learning? Walk me through how it's been so powerful.
Yeah. So reinforcement learning is this... I think of it as this third pillar to machine learning. A lot of machine learning is supervised machine learning, unsupervised learning, and reinforcement learning. And in supervised machine learning, the learning happens with what's called imitation learning, where the system is kind of learning from human examples. You basically give the system a training set of input-output pairs, and the algorithm kind of learns that input to output mapping, right? And that supervised machine learning has served us well for decades, whether it's learning to rank search results or email spam classification systems like that. In unsupervised machine learning, for folks that are curious, is where you have a system that automatically learns structures in the data without any human input. Right, like clustering algorithms are examples of that. If you look at old school Google News that would cluster news stories, that was an example of that. Reinforcement learning is this really cool technique where there is no supervisor. So the system is not learning from a human. The system learns effectively by trial and error. Move 37, Ashni, that you spoke about, is this famous move in Go. And the AlphaGo system that DeepMind trained, actually the original system was a form of imitation learning where the system was trained on moves that Go players would make. But they also did lots of reinforcement learning on top of that. Eventually, they came up with a system called AlphaZero, which learned basically by playing against itself, right? Before it started to play against humans. And the cool thing about this trial and error based learning is the basic idea is you have an agent that is learning to maximize its expected future rewards. And the agent is kind of figuring out what types of moves tend to result in it getting a reward at the end of the game versus not. Of course, in a system like Go, you get a reward if you win the game. You get a high reward if you win the game, you get a negative reward or a lower reward if you lose the game. And the system learns what types of moves tend to result in winning or losing, right? And move 37 was this crazy move where it felt alien to most humans because no human would ever think like that or move like that, which is kind of cool when you have these trial and error based AI systems that could evolve strategies that look very alien or very different from how humans might approach it. I personally think reinforcement learning is kind of cool for a couple of reasons. And there is, of course, the interesting paper by David Silver and Richard Sutton on the era of experience, which we should link in the show notes, where they talk about how reinforcement learning has the potential to transcend human intelligence. Today, of course, there's a lot of talk about artificial superintelligence. Like, we've gone past artificial general intelligence now, and it's artificial superintelligence. And the authors basically talk about how a system that's fundamentally trained only by supervised fine-tuning and reinforcement learning with human feedback might be capped by human intelligence because human raters are basically creating data sets for supervised fine-tuning with input prompts and output completions, or human raters are giving feedback with a system called reinforcement learning with human feedback, where humans are rating the outputs of a model to teach the model what type of outputs humans tend to prefer. But in a pure RL-based system, humans are not needed for that. Humans are needed just to create what are called verifiers. You just need a way to help the model verify whether it got the result right. So you get to this paradigm of generate and verify. And as long as you have a model that can generate a bunch of plausible solutions, maybe it generates 100 solutions and has a very efficient way to verify whether the solutions are correct, the system could eventually hill climb and figure out the right solution. And this paradigm of generate verify like works really well for problems where you can verify like coding, math, etc.
So you began kind of talking and diving into this whole question of supervised versus unsupervised learning, just to make sure, you know, we kind of have a good understanding here, right? There's this separation between pure reinforcement learning and something that has more of a human in the loop, right? Which involves SFT and RLHF. It can be said that RL is central to agentic AI. So how much human interaction and data do we need then? And when? In which use cases? For example, you mentioned a little bit, you mentioned coding as a great use case for RL. Curious to kind of dive into that a little bit more and see where Turing's role is in that.
That's actually a great summary, Ashni, of like how to think about it. Another way to think about it, which Andre Karpathy, one of the co-founders of OpenAI, talks about is... he has this really nice analogy where you can think of pre-training as a model skimming the pages of a textbook. Imagine a math textbook that's describing calculus. Pre-training, you're just reading chapters and chapters, right? You can think of supervised fine-tuning as an example problem that's laid out where somebody's giving a problem and a step-by-step way to actually come up with the solution. You're showing the model how to work out the solution, but actually laying out the answer. Reinforcement learning based paradigms are when you give a problem and just give the answer. Mm-hmm. Now the model has to try out different solutions to make sure that it can come to the answer. Right? I thought that was a really neat way to describe it. Your question was, what is the role of the human in generating data for these reinforcement learning-based systems? A popular misunderstanding is RL does not need human input. Actually, RL needs more advanced human input. For coding, for example, the way you would package that would be I'll give you examples for supervised fine-tuning, reinforcement learning with human feedback, and reinforcement learning. In supervised fine-tuning, the way you would generate data for coding, let's say you wanted to improve the model for like Python data science. You might have a human, firstly, you would like create a taxonomy of let's say Python data science, and you would evaluate the model at the leaf nodes to see where the model is weak in. And in areas where the model is weak in, you would then start generating data. For example, imagine a taxonomy that looks like Python data science, supervised machine learning. Under supervised machine learning, let's say we go to neural networks, deep neural networks, maybe we are looking at some applications of deep neural networks like natural language processing. And then let's go one more level down and where we are messing around with PyTorch, say. And one question for supervised fine-tuning might be a prompt that is something like, hey, write a program using PyTorch to classify the content in my X timeline into positive sentiment, neutral sentiment, negative sentiment, right? And then the human writes code for like how you would actually write a program for this particular use case. So that's supervised fine-tuning, right? Now with reinforcement learning and you can have single turn or multi-turn where you have a conversation with a model. Now in reinforcement learning with human feedback, imagine for the same question, the model has output two types of solutions, and the human is rating which solution is better. Now, the human might have different criteria to grade the result. They might, okay, this one passes all the test cases, is formatted better, it's commented better, it's more readable, versus maybe another implementation of the algorithm, maybe maybe this is not very maintainable, and the human could pick, right? So you're teaching the model human preferences. So that's reinforcement learning with human feedback. Now in pure RL, the pure RL way to do this is you, typically the way this works is you'd have a prompt, and you'd come up with a way to, test cases. The humans are generating test cases, which are basically verifiers to check if the program passes the test cases, right? Mm-hmm. It might remind you, Ashni, a little bit of SWEbench, which is a popular benchmark for coding, where it's a collection of pull requests, repos, and test cases for those pull requests. I think the cool thing about this is you kind of show the model these test cases and these questions, and the model is like figuring out in token space how to write something that compiles and actually passes test cases. And it's kind of mind-boggling when you think about it, because when you think about chess or Go or even Atari games and you're using reinforcement learning there, a game is a very bounded environment, right? Like there are well-defined rules.
There's continuous feedback and a very, very clearly defined metric or verifier.
That's exactly right. And it's kind of crazy how for coding, where in theory, like the space is so large, but the models are able to do really well. And this was actually one of the larger interesting results from DeepSeek from earlier in the year, where they basically used reinforcement learning to match the performance of some of the top reasoning models on coding and simple math using this type of paradigm. So here the human is writing, the role of the human is to write prompts and verifiers, right? And you can imagine like having more complex verifiers, like unit tests are one way to verify whether something is good, but you might have more complex verifiers that also, unit tests don't really, the unit test way of verification doesn't check for, okay, is this piece of code in the same style as the rest of the code base? Are there any security loopholes in the code? Is it commented well? Is it written in a maintainable way? Those things are not judged, so you might write more advanced verifiers. In fact, at Turing, we have a more advanced fuzzy verifier that will verify whether a pull request is ready to be merged. So humans are creating like these prompts and verifiers, and this paradigm works for problems where you can verify the result very efficiently, which is true for code, for math, for certain types of STEM. It's tough for certain open-ended problems. For example, imagine if we had a prompt. We imagine if we had a prompt for, "Hey, summarize this Turing test podcast episode between Ashni and Jonathan on reinforcement learning. How do you verify whether the summary is correct?" Right, like it's kind of hard to do it. There are some approximations you could do. So this paradigm like works well for these more well-defined problems. I would say coding, math, and training agents. These are sort of the top use cases for reinforcement learning.
Right, right. And of course, human feedback is necessary when we want to ground the output of a model in humanity, which actually takes me to my next question. So I know we're chatting about AlphaGo and, of course, the famous Move 37. What I think that made a lot of researchers realize is there is, of course, a ceiling to everything humans have done thus far. And inherently, to have a breakthrough, whether it's a model or a human, we need to be able to break apart from a ceiling. Move 37 in that famous 2016 AlphaGo game was proof that sometimes we need to make decisions that humans may not even decide for themselves. That was a 1 in 10,000 chance of a human making that same move that the system was able to choose. So kind of building on that story, do you think a heavy reliance on human data inherently curbs the capability of an AI model? In other words, are we inherently limiting AI performance? To keep uncovering new Move 37s, do we have to break away from human data entirely or at least significantly reduce our dependence on it?
I think human data is really important in a variety of different parts of the LLM training pipeline. There are still areas where human data is needed, even for pre-training in addition to, of course, obviously for post-training. I think reinforcement learning is just like another vector to another vector for growth. I don't think it replaces this. For example, when you think about training enterprise agents, these are agents that can execute complex multi-step workflows in a real-world business setting. Human data is super important for stuff like this, even though this is done in the construct of what's called an RL gym. A gym as in not for humans to train in, but for agents to train in. So human input is really important in building these RL gyms. Before we get there, Ashni, I want to spend a moment to motivate the need for an RL gym, right? So these enterprise agents are going to be huge for automating all types of knowledge work and really unleashing the potential of these models beyond the consumer applications we've seen with ChatGPT and others, right? So one way I think about it is think of a four-dimensional matrix. Like for every industry you can think of, retail, life sciences, healthcare, CPG, for every industry you can think of, and let the second dimension be every function in that industry, like software engineering, marketing, sales, finance, etc. Think of every role inside a function. So let's say we picked marketing. Inside marketing, there could be a CMO, a director of performance marketing, an SEO analyst, a brand marketer, etc. Right? And now let's go to the fourth dimension. Let's say we picked the director of performance marketing, right? That human does a lot of workflows as part of their day-to-day job. One workflow might be, let me figure out which marketing channel is giving me the highest ROI to reduce my customer acquisition cost or to increase my lead volume, right? So for that particular workflow, now we've picked four dimensions, industry, function, role, and workflow, right? If you unroll this matrix, that's $30 trillion of knowledge work. And it kind of, every human role is a collection of these workflows. And very soon, we will have enterprise agents that will be able to execute those workflows, right? And reinforcement learning will be key for that. The way you do that is by building these RL gyms. And we've been building the capability to do these across both consumer and enterprise, right? On the consumer end, think about different types of consumer websites like a DoorDash or an Uber or a Kayak. So we are building these. In RL gyms, like think of the taxonomy as you could either be doing it for consumer applications or you could be doing it for enterprise software, like for Salesforce, for HubSpot, for ZoomInfo, these other tools that people might use to do work. That's one distinction. You could do it for consumer or you could do it for enterprise. The problem statement is still the same. Can you train an agent to execute a multi-step workflow in a realistic business context that could span different features inside an application or it could span different pieces of software itself?
Right, right. Right.
These RL gyms could either be UI clones where you design it to train computer use agents that would read the screen and use a keyboard or mouse to take action, or you might design it to be used for function calling or tool use, where the model might be making different function calls. And I think this concept of an RL gym is really neat, where you build these environments for training these reinforcement learning agents, and you log the UI state and the system state of this environment, right? You can think of it almost like a mini world model.
Right.
And what the humans do, Ashni, like to your question, what do humans do in this realm, is a human enterprise worker would define prompts that cover some of their workflows. So imagine a business development representative, a BDR, for a B2B SaaS company that's selling into healthcare, say. that human, when they are trying to prospect leads and come up with like a custom message to reach out to them, is going through a workflow where they're using tools like ZoomInfo or Salesforce or LinkedIn. They're going through that workflow. And that's one example of a specific prompt or a specific use case. So we would have like the humans create hundreds of these prompts along with hundreds of verifiers so that we can check the environment's system state and the environment's data model to see whether this task was completed successfully or not, right? For example, there could be some task about updating Salesforce in a certain way or using a sequence of tools to accomplish some action or to look up some piece of information across different applications. So the humans are creating prompts and verifiers, and Turing kind of creates this RL gem that we Dockerize and share with our clients. Now our clients have the ability to train their agents inside the setting where the agent would look at the prompt, and it would, in the computer use example, the agent would be clicking different links in the application or navigating the UI. In the function calling example, it would just be making tool calls and iterate its way to get to a solution where it eventually verifies. I think an era of enterprise agents is very, very close. And it's going to be, I think it's going to be one of the biggest ways in which we actually recognize GDP growth or real economic growth this year with AI.
I guess summarizing that, what an RL gem really is an alternate world, some sort of simulation in which an agent operates to be able to optimize some sort of programmed verifier while taking care of any concerns, whether that be with privacy. For example, you know, if our use case is for healthcare, making sure that we are abiding by HIPAA laws, or even if we're working with an enterprise client, being able to work with data that's not necessarily proprietary. And the way that Turing kind of does that is if we had to outline it in four steps. One is we get an expert input on which workflows are the top priority. Then we collect the expert demonstrations. That's kind of the human part of this entire loop. Then we build that UI replica. So that's if this is for a computer use agent, but we're building this environment, building the gym. And then lastly, we define the training and the evaluation data sets. And that's how our agent essentially is able to function and train in this gym, because that's what gyms are for, of course. Is that kind of the correct understanding?
You're exactly right, Ashni. You're exactly right. That was a great summary. I think of it as this trifecta of human experts creating prompts that require the agent to perform a multi-step workflow, and creating verifiers that can check whether the prompt was correctly executed. The environment that captures the system state, the UI state, and the data state. So it's environment, prompts, and verifiers in a nice Dockerized setup that could be spun up where you can train your agents.
Would you say this is similar to this idea of the era of experience and where agents are learning from their environment?
It's very similar, but I don't think David Silver and Richard Sutton would like this very much. They may kind of sort of like it, but they may not like it as much as another thing that I think they're alluding to in their paper. So the thing they talk about in their paper, Ashni, is this idea of grounding in real world experience. They talk about, so you see my Oura ring on my finger, right? So they talk about an agent that could presumably have a goal of helping me improve my fitness, say. And let's say it wants me to lower my resting heart rate. Let's say that we give the agent the goal. You get a reward if you lower my resting heart rate or increase my HRV, the heart rate variability thing. Now, this could recommend different diets, exercise routines, other maybe some crazy notifications to get me to go out more. And then the Richard Sutton way, the era of experience way, is to use feedback from actual real world data. Did my HRV actually go up, or did my resting heart rate actually come down? And using that as feedback. So the reward, much like in the Go game, did you win the game or did you lose the game? Here, think of it as trying a strategy where, did we reduce Jonathan's resting heart rate or not, right? That's real grounding, grounding in the real world. What we have, and they're one of their complaints against, I mean, they're very respectful of like how SFT and RLHF is actually super helpful in making these foundation models really useful. But the challenge is the human becomes the limiting factor, right? It's the it's humans putting data through SFT and RLHF. In the concept of the RL gyms, the humans are still generating the prompts and writing the verifiers. I think what David Silver and Richard Sutton would have liked is a system where, imagine, Ashni, like an RL agent was sitting at Turing and coming up with company strategy and product roadmap prioritization. And the feedback it gets is, how is Turing's revenue growing? So it's grounded in real feedback, right? So that's taking the human completely out of the loop. But yeah, so that's, I think they would like that more, but they probably would like this too, because this is also kind of neat. It's kind of like, it's learning through trial and error without being programmed, right?
So what's your thesis? Do you think to get to ASI, we need to remove the human in the loop? Is that the next step forward in automation?
So I'm biased. I believe in human potential. I mean, Turing is all about unleashing the world's untapped human potential. We have 4 million plus software engineers. I'm biased, but I'm biased because I have a worldview that sort of drove me to start Turing, like which also like supports my answer to your question, which is so it's very clear that scaling up large neural networks works, right? So deep learning works. The current transformer architecture with lots and lots of data during pre-training, during post-training helps, right? Like the so we know that works. So that's going to help. Test time compute unlocked another vector for improving performance, having the model think longer. So you're trading off some test time compute cycles for training time compute cycles. That also works. Reinforcement learning also works. So I am not, I think like we'll keep inventing other technologies also along the way. I'd be very surprised if 3 years from now, the recipe is still the same. There will be something new that we're probably using. I'm just bullish on so many smart people across all these frontier AI labs spending their collective human cycles to accelerate the path to artificial superintelligence. I think there is still a lot of room for transferring intelligence from human minds into machine minds. And there is still a lot more knowledge we can distill into LLMs from humans. I do think the bar has gone up, where 2 years ago, maybe a median human in an area could probably contribute useful tokens to improve the model's performance. But now the models have gotten smarter and smarter, where now you need really expert humans in different areas working together to break the model and advance the model. You've heard me say this, Ashni. It 1 year ago, we probably needed maybe Iron Man to like improve the model's performance in a certain dimension. Now we need the Avengers, right? Like, if you want to advance the model in physics, you might have to daisy chain an expert physicist, probably somebody with a PhD in physics from a top school, with a software engineer who could write code to implement a simulator to test some theory in physics. And then you might need a data scientist to analyze the results of the simulation. That three-person team is kind of what you need to improve the model's performance through supervised fine-tuning or reinforcement learning with human feedback, or in some cases to create these generate-verify paradigms for reinforcement learning. So I'm pro-human. I just think we're going to reach an era where every human is just going to be 100x more productive.
Yeah.
And even for the human to generate data that'll break the model, the human will stand on the shoulders of AI. So at Turing today, what we do is oftentimes the human will work together with an AI to generate data that can move the AI forward. It's a little bit loopy. It's like AI helping humans improve AI. It may sound a little bit like Terminator, but I think this is the positive version.
Well, it's interesting because the phrase in the Valley has always been standing on the shoulders of giants. And now I think that co-evolution of humans and AI is becoming more evident when we kind of reframe that thinking. I have one last question for you that I thought would be an interesting thought experiment, right? Kind of diving back to our understanding of RLGyms. Could we one day automate your job? Could we create a gym that is a Turing 2.0 and the verifiers perhaps, I don't know, did revenues grow? Did Turing become a unicorn? And perhaps have an agent trained in that way? What's your thesis on that?
100%. I think the CEO's job will also be automated. And as you know, Ashni, we're working on some projects for exactly that. If you look at what a CEO does, often it's distilling information across different sources, analyzing data, using tools, and making decisions, right? And making decisions often with, a good way to verify whether the decision was correct or not, right? At Turing scale, like you can track whether did this decision contribute to revenues growing or revenues not growing. I think the ingredients are there. I think the four things to get right to artificial superintelligence are multimodality, reasoning, tool use, and coding. Multimodality so that you can understand what's on a screen, understand rich inputs like images, graphs, other types of information. Reasoning so that you can think and plan sort of your in terms of your strategy to achieve a certain goal. Tool use, because we use a lot of different tools. One of those tools could also be a code editor, could be other types of tools to analyze data. And then, of course, in cases where you don't have the right tools, if you've mastered coding, you could create the tool yourself. So if you had those four things, you could do anything, I would say, including a CEO's job. If you were the CEO of a physical company, like I'm trying to think, like if you were the CEO of a company where what you were doing was somehow in the world of atoms, not bits, then I think there is a little more time. But even that, like with embodied AI and embodied AI with ChatGPT, Gemini-like brains, like those models will still improve. I think like we're well on our way to automating everything that's digital. I'm super excited about it because I feel like I'm going to be 100x more productive than I am today. Because humans are fundamentally token bandwidth constrained, right? If you look at how I operate, there is so much activity happening on Turing's Jira, for example, in terms of our engineering and product development. There is a lot of activity happening on Salesforce. There is a lot of revenue insights captured in NetSuite. There are a lot of tokens from like hundreds of Zoom meetings that people might have at Turing every single day. There is no way for me to absorb all of those tokens, synthesize it, and act. But in a world where I'm standing on the shoulders of a giant that is a model, you can imagine leveraging test time compute to be able to do these really deep analysis thoughts. Like every day I could start my day with a CEO daily brief that says, here's what's red, yellow, green at Turing, and here's what you need to do to make the reds green. And the next iteration is the model has already made it green. Anyway, I sent this email to this person to do this instead, to make this change to the strategy. We'll know the results in a week, whether it's or not.
Exactly.
And by the way, I thought it's time to raise the next round. So I've started conversations there as well.
Exactly. Nothing slips under the radar. And I think that's exactly the premise of us trying to mass automate the company.
Yes. And in that universe, maybe I'll actually take some days off, although my EA would not believe it.
I don't think that's possible for you, Jonathan.
Yeah, I wonder what I would do. Maybe I might babysit the model and be really annoying. Could you think a little longer and recompute your answer?
Well, thank you so much for that. This was a great conversation. We chatted about everything from the differences between RL, RLHF, SFT, to the applications that Turing is working on, from coding to various other multimodal systems. We talked about the building of RL gyms, and we talked about the era of experience and how the two might differ, as well as your thesis on the importance of humans and their growing importance, even in this next era of automation. I think this was a fantastic conversation, and it was great to chat with you, Jonathan.
Great. Thank you, Ashni. This was fun.
See you all next week.